everyone. Welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our weekly conversations include you. And if you'd like to join us anytime during the program, here's our number. From Oahu, 941-3689. And if you call us from the neighbor islands or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else, you can get to us at 877-941-3689. What can we say about the Waikiki War Memorial Natatorium that hasn't already been said? The question of should it stay and be preserved or should it be redeveloped has had a long 30-year journey toward an answer. A year ago this month, many people thought there was one. That was when the governor and Honolulu's mayor announced an agreed plan to demolish the pool and bleachers and create a memorial park. Yesterday, the National Trust for Historic Preservation made its own announcement. It was adding the natatorium to the list of national treasures, and that has fueled the natatorium debate once again. Today, we're going to talk about what may be next for the natatorium and, more broadly, what goes into designating historic places, the criteria, and the often long quest for preservation. Joining us from the National Trust for Historic Preservation, Brian Turner is a senior field officer and attorney. He represents the National Trust to facilitate public participation in the preservation of sites, buildings, and objects of national significance. David Brown is the executive vice president and chief preservation officer. He directs the Trust's assortment of preservation programs. Those would include direct action to protect America's national treasures, advocacy for preservation incentives and laws, support for local preservation leadership, building of new historic site models, and promotion of preservation's role in environmental sustainability. And you're here, too, and we want to hear from you. 941-3689 if you're on Oahu, or 877-941-3689 if you're listening from the neighbor islands or anyplace else. Welcome.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Nice to see you again, Brian Turner, and welcome to you, David Brown.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
When people hear about the National Trust, do they have confusion about what the Trust actually does and that this is a privately funded organization?
All the time. A lot of people think of us as a government agency, but actually we're a nonprofit membership organization that advocates for historic places all around the country.
So how, David, do you find what it is that you think is worthy of preserving?
Well, as the country's only national preservation organization that focuses on historic preservation, we are looking at places that have national significance or national implications. And places like the Natatorium certainly rise to that level. But we are focused on places that mean something to the communities where they are, but also mean something in terms of our history as our country.
So community organizations would approach you?
They often do, and we certainly have been involved with community organizations here in Honolulu and Hawaii in a number of issues, including the Natatorium for decades, really.
And including Pearl Harbor about 15 years ago.
Including Pearl Harbor about 15 years ago. We've had a rich and productive relationship at Pearl Harbor with groups like Historic Hawaii Foundation and the Navy.
For most people who are not involved with historic preservation, when they see that sometimes these battles go on for a very long time trying to get something with some sort of designation, not necessarily from your organization, but just in general, and often wonder why. Why, if it's significant, why isn't it being preserved? And very often we'll have people call us and say things like, but it has such significance. How do you prove significance? What's the criteria for that?
Well, that's a great question, and there are different ways of looking at significance. Of course, the federal government, through the National Register of Historic Places, has criteria for significance, and they look at things like the history, the associations of a place, the architecture, and the context, and how much of the site remains, and so its integrity. And that's sort of the way in terms of determining significance from the National Register point of view, which is an important place to start as we're looking at significance. But we also talk with a number of communities, and there are things that mean things to communities that perhaps don't rise to those levels of National Register designation, and yet they're still important. And this is especially true when we're dealing with communities that perhaps are not part of the majority history in their community, and they have places that have different meanings to those members of their community. And as we're looking at trying to preserve the broad story of America, we're looking at a number of different ways of meaning. And preservation is a lot about not only memories, but it's about continuity.
Does that make it more or less difficult when you're talking about some part of history that's not necessarily part of the collective broad story that we all seem to carry with us in some ways, but something that's very specific to a certain community? Does that make it more difficult to preserve?
It may. Certainly preservation started as we focused on the Founding Fathers and the places that everyone could agree were important, the Mount Vernons of the world. But as we've become broader in our understanding of what's important to a community, sometimes it is difficult for certain segments to understand why these places need to be saved, why they mean something to the community that cares for them and that's part of their memory. But also they see these places not only as part of their memory, but part of their future, and they want to carry those forward. But it can make those discussions more difficult, but we think they're more robust as well.
When you look at Hawaii, and obviously the long discussion over the Natatorium is just one of the examples. Mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor, as we mentioned before, is another one. Are there others, Brian, that are on your list that you already have somehow targeted that might be the next discussion?
Right at this point, we're focusing in on the Natatorium. That's our principal focus. But we're always kind of in our discussions with the preservation groups here on Hawaii, which are really doing, Historic Hawaii Foundation was mentioned, they're doing great work. And we stay informed through groups like them in every state almost that we work in. One of the issues that's come up recently is the determining the future of Haniuliuli Gulch, which the National Park Service was asked by Congress to do a special resources study, and a draft study is out where the Park Service is recommending the designation of the site as a unit of the national park system. So they're now inviting public comment on that, and that's something, we're supportive of.
And that seems to go back to David's point about parts of a community that find a very important segment of history that's wrapped up very much in the community's perception, not necessarily in a national perception, but in this case, it certainly is both.
Right. The story, for those of listening who aren't aware, Haniuliuli was a site where Japanese citizens were interned during World War II. So it's a site where memories are it's not a place of celebration necessarily, but it's a place that we don't want to lose.
And that brings up another point about how preservation is done. Very often people say, oh, well, that's beautiful. It needs to be preserved. Or it's old. Look at this architecture. But this is more than just preserving something that's beautiful.
Right. One of our colleagues, Tom Mays, has done a lot of really great research on this. All of the reasons why save old things. And in addition to just having beautiful communities, there's points about memory and individual identity, civic identity. I think at the Trust see that we have an obligation to future generations. It's a question of what we leave behind and how we're going to educate our kids about what came before them. And we have to have a mind for the future as we make these decisions.
As those decisions are being made, and as obviously you've said, you're mindful of what's happening or what may happen in the future with other generations, there's also the changes that happen in communities where you have a very different demographic that comes in and you may lose some of those community memories of a site. Have you had instances with that?
Well, all the time. I mean, America is a place, a very dynamic place. And communities change over time, but there's something about the tangibility of a place that can really bring about that memory to a community that maybe wasn't aware of its importance. David and I had a chance to visit Iolani Palace while we were here, and I understand that for a time, people didn't know what to do with it. It was considered for demolition. And now it's an incredible site. I think anybody who visits Hawaii may not be aware of that history. And it's something that I think we both felt they should be exposed to.
One of the concerns in Hawaii is as population is shifting, and some projections have said that the closer that we come to 2020, the fewer people will be in Hawaii who are actually born here, and that will change the way perhaps some of these locations are regarded, and also what may happen with historic preservation. So that's a very real thing in many ways for us. Tonight we're taking a look at historic preservation. Yes, we're going to talk about the Natatorium too, but there are other places that perhaps you think should be preserved. We're talking with two from the National Trust tonight, Brian Turner, Senior Field Officer and Attorney, and Executive Vice President and Chief Preservation Officer David Brown. And you, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Walter now, calling us from Salt Lake. Aloha, Walter. Welcome to Town Square.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Nice to have you.
I was wondering, it's going to cost way more to preserve them. Natatorium, but Governor Neil Abercrombie's plans are to keep the arches but just move it forward. What's wrong with that? It's still preserving it, but, you know, he just wants to get rid of the pool and make it safer because to, you know, do construction on that is going to cost a lot more money. So I was wondering, why do you disagree with that?
All right, let me get our guest to talk about that tonight. Now, this is the argument. I mean, this has been going on for a long time. Last year, this time, we were told that it would cost about $70 million to do the restoration effort, as opposed to a little over $18 million to be able to do the demolition of the pool and the bleachers, move the arches at the arch, and then to create a memorial park. And obviously, this has been the bone of contention about really what that price tag is all about. And even as recently as yesterday, hearing from both the governor's office and the mayor's office that both want to wait and see what happens with the EIS due out next year. But your perspective in moving the arches, does that in fact preserve a site if that were to happen?
Well, no. With all respect to the caller, the Natatorium is comprised of three significant features. One is an arch and arcade. The second is a bleacher structure. And the third is a swim basin with a pool. And it was designed as a pool. It's listed on the National Register with those qualities. If you destroy it, it really doesn't honor that design intent or any of the history. We understand that the arch would be not moved but reconstructed nearby. It would significantly alter the integrity of the resource.
David?
Well, and I think, as Brian suggested, the Natatorium Memorial is the entire structure. It's the pool, the arches, and the bleachers. And it was designed to be a living memorial, which I think that's one of the amazing things about this place and what makes it so unique. It was not just as a memory place for World War I veterans, but it was a place where people could come and remember World War I veterans, but they could also have recreation and repose, and it was seen as a living memorial. And we don't have very much left in Hawaii that memorializes the World War I veterans, the 10,000 Hawaiians who served in World War I. And this place was designed by the architects and the city at the time and the state to be a place not just for the past but for the future. And that's why we think that it's so important to think about this as a complete memorial. I think the other thing that the caller brought up, which we're looking to the EIS process to help with, is this question of cost. We've heard these numbers. We haven't really seen what's the basis for the $70 million, for the rehabilitation versus the $18 million for demolition. We don't know what's in those numbers and what they mean. We certainly, one of the reasons the National Trust wanted to become involved was to be able to understand, be able to look at those, have them looked at from outside experts who are comfortable working in these types of situations, and really come to an understanding of what the true cost not only of rehabilitation is, which this seems to be a high cost to us, but also what's the true cost of a demolition and the environmental costs that would go along with that. And so we think the governor told us that the EIS process was where those kinds of discussions would come out, and we think that's the best process for figuring out the way forward.
Which seems to be the story that we are hearing from sort of all sectors, that until that happens, none of those hard, real answers may be available, which in effect says we're kind of in a holding pattern. Would you agree with that? There's not a whole lot more that we're going to be talking about except for how people feel emotionally one way or the other?
Absolutely. As I mentioned on the call, on the show yesterday, the EIS and then the law that provides for an EIS is intended to have those figures available for the public and disclose what's behind those costs. So we think it's very preliminary to come out with numbers without sort of supporting data.
All right. We've got a caller on the line. If you'd like to be next, join us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're talking more broadly about historic preservation and specifically about the announcement concerning the Natatorium now being designated as a national treasure. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Rick, calling us from Kaimana Beach.
Hi, gentlemen.
Hi there.
Aloha. Welcome to Hawaii.
Aloha.
Yes. I hope you've been receiving a good welcome here. Local people absolutely have weighed in on this. We've had a Waikiki Natatorium Task Force that met for 6 months, of which I was a member. And during the task force, we heard from all parties, interested parties, what they call stakeholders. And this was sponsored by the city. It was determined by the city engineers, and the Army Corps of Engineers, of course, weighed in, as did many other people, that there is no restoration of the Natatorium possible, that the Natatorium must be raised and rebuilt from the ground up. And the cost of that, by the city engineers, who considered it very carefully, was about $70 million. So this is not an arbitrary figure that's just floating around. We use the experts that we have here in Hawaii, who are very good experts. We don't need necessarily have people coming from the mainland to tell us what our engineering and construction costs will be. That said, in the face of all your run-out today in the Huffington Post, you had a big story. And in the Atlantic Magazine today, you had a big story. And certainly the front page story that you got in the Advertiser yesterday, which was a full front page, there was something we have here called the Big Q in our local newspaper, which is a question that's asked every day. Today the question was whether the community favored a restored Natatorium or a new beach. And the poll came back 3,810 people in favor of a new beach, which represented 90% of the community, and 478 people in favor of a restored or demolished and rebuilt Natatorium. 90% of the local community favored a new beach, which would cost about $18 million compared to $70 million.
Rick, what would you say would be the main reason that you see for that kind of response? Is it because we have a change of generations? We're very far from World War I. Obviously, the thing has been crumbling and closed for so many years, and a lot of people don't really have some memories of that place other than being a point of contention and not really very user-friendly.
Well, you know, I've been swimming at Kaimana Beach straight for 50 years, and I certainly swam in the Natatorium. And when I moved here in 1965 at age 20, I was a competitive athlete, and I worked out, and I'm still a ocean swimmer every day. And the Natatorium was a horrible place to swim. It was murky. You couldn't grab a hold of the edge. It was 3 feet above your head, and the water was not clear. It was a structure that just absolutely didn't work. It was very much like an Edsel. It was pretty to look at, but it wasn't functional. And when it closed in 1979, it would close for good reason, and as did all of the other saltwater swimming pools around the country, because they breed MRSA and staph and any other kind of contagion, because the pool just can't flush well enough, and it was going to be dependent upon the tidal flow. And secondly, you can't decontaminate a saltwater pool. In other words, they were playing science with 1920s engineering, and they did it all over the country, and it just
didn't pan out.
Work.
Rick, thank you so much for your call. Glad
thank
you called.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to hear their response to how they feel about the community weighing in at 90%.
We're going to give them the chance to do that right now. Thanks so much for your call.
Well,
David,
you know, polls in newspapers and on radios are not scientific polls, and we don't know. I mean, as you suggested, there are a lot of people here in Honolulu today who don't understand the meaning and the place of the Natatorium. All they have seen for 35 years is a crumbling pool. And oftentimes the choices to save places are not necessarily the ones that the community is looking at, sort of two different black and white types of decisions. It's like, well, we're going to, you know, it looks like it could be easier to clean this up rather than to restore it and reuse it. So while I appreciate Rick's point about the community weighing in on the question of the day, I think that is just what it is. It's a, you know, it's an unscientific measure of where the community stands. But even with that, I think it is important where a community thinks about its, what a community thinks about its history. And we've been involved with people who swam in the Natatorium who have very fond memories of that, who saw it as a place that was a wonderful aquatic facility for Honolulu, and very much think that would be a great place for the future. And so I think people are going to have different perspectives on whether the pool worked or not. And I can't get into that. I didn't swim in the Natatorium. So.
Well, for a lot of people, though, this is going to boil down to also the cost of it and really wanting to see some of that. Rick's point was, you know, when we had these meetings, and this is what we heard from a great many engineers who were brought in to answer some of those questions. These are the figures they came up with. Now, that was a little while ago. That wasn't exactly yesterday. Things have changed. Real costs, hard costs. As we know, even if you get something, you know, a week ago, it may change in the actual doing of it.
Well, and the, you know, the panel that the task force that was looking at the future of the Natatorium didn't agree. It wasn't a unanimous decision in terms of what the future should be. And I know also that folks who are on that task force feel like they don't understand where those numbers came from. And so I think it's a legitimate question to say we need to go through an environmental impact study process. And we need to look at the hard numbers. It's easy to say, well, this is $70 million. It's too expensive. But I think it is important to understand the cost not only of demolition but the environmental costs that come with that. I think it's also important to understand what real restoration cost might be.
All right. Well, while we just put those numbers on the side, I'm
sure
going to give you a couple of numbers that you can remember right now if you want to get into this conversation. 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, that's the number to call, 941-3689. Or from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream elsewhere, get to us at 877-941-3689. Going now to Rick, I'm sorry, Jeff calling us from Waimanalo.
Here we are.
Hi there.
It's kind of a double-sided conversation tonight, so I'd like to have two brief comments. One is that sometimes maybe having a monument be a monument is okay if we make it safe with no rebar sticking up, for people to enjoy it as it is. Maybe it doesn't need to be restored. You know, it's right next to the biggest swimming pool that we have anyway. That's that. The other one is that I have a career in old buildings, and mostly in the Midwest, in historic old buildings. My only comment about the other bigger battle is that in Madison and Chicago, we, in the 70s and 80s, we won a lot of battles about restoring and keeping old buildings available and rehabbing them and changing them and making them part of it. But when I was back there recently, it turned out that we've lost the war because we won the battles, we became complacent, and the development issues and the development people did not.
So it seems that you're sort of putting out there the fact that you've got to be constantly vigilant because populations do change, areas do change, and nothing is forever, even perhaps in some cases historic preservation.
Well, I mean, you know, if you go to Italy and places in the Mediterranean, you see wonderful monuments that were once seats of government, and now they're monuments, and they're treated as such. Maybe that's what we need to do and make a decision, because we have wonderful old buildings here. We have wonderful old neighborhoods, and we're losing that local flavor because we are making decisions that don't reflect an appreciation of that.
Or may not have some cooperation. There are people who have been calling us for years saying, what about the Queen Theater in Kaimuki? What a great structure.
Isn't that a great old building?
Yeah, wouldn't that be a great old building to be able to save, and seemingly thwarted at every turn? Jeff, thanks so much for your call. I'm really glad you called.
Thank you so much for the program.
Aloha. A pleasure. Going now to Eric, calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Eric. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, aloha. I happen to be actually just outside the natatorium as we speak, and listening to the conversation, I couldn't agree more with the previous caller, Jeff, who clearly demonstrates an appreciation for preservation of historic structures, of old buildings, of the historic fabric that comprises the not only the history of Honolulu itself, but of the islands. And one of the things that seems to be left out in the conversation regarding the natatorium is the fact that, A, it was truly a living memorial, as one of the experts in your panel has mentioned. The memorial is not the arch itself. The memorial is the pool. It was designed as a living memorial that people would enjoy and participate in. It was essentially an interactive memorial to celebrate those 10,000 people who served in World War I. Above the arch, what it says is the war memorial. Now, most people don't quite appreciate what that means. The war memorial, it was in reference to the Great War, World War I, which wasn't given a number until World War II came along. So the fact that we had a memorial, one of the few in the country, by the way, to World War I, is something that if you would just extrapolate to 100 years from now, people thinking about World War II and erasing their memory regarding World War II and its significance in world history. So that's one point. Secondly, I wanted to address the point that the earlier caller, Rick, made regarding the costs and the panels of experts that he quotes. I would beg to differ substantially. I was part of the team involved in the letting of the design contract for the restoration of the natatorium, and there was an actual contract signed with a licensed contractor for $13.5 million. Now, I recognize Rick's voice, and he will be the one who will tell you that he was part of the team who sued to stop renovation, even though from a design perspective, the design was intended to cure essentially the flaws that he mentioned. And in fact, in 1927, when the natatorium was built, it was under-designed in terms of flow, but those were all designs that were cured in the restoration plans that were done in the early 2000s.
All right, Eric, let's stop there and let's get the panelists to feed.
So those are the two key points I'd like to make. One final point is that the natatorium is to the sport of swimming what St. Andrews is to the sport of golf. We have here on the island one of the critical keystones to the sport of competitive sport of swimming worldwide that's recognized from people all over the world except by us here living in Hawaii.
And sometimes that often happens that it's almost like you're not being able to be a prophet in your own land. Thanks very much for the call, Eric. We're going to talk about this a little bit and get to our other callers in just a minute. I mean, very clearly, just demonstrated by the last couple of callers that we've had, the issue of the natatorium is deeply held. It's emotionally held as much as financially based, and really tough for a lot of people to grapple with. Until we get some hard numbers in the EIS, it seems we're going to have a lot more of this conversation unless we're able to come to some point of neutrality until we can actually take a look at some of those numbers. But what do you both hear when you listen to callers, as we've heard over the last couple of minutes?
Well, one of the reasons we're really involved here is that the EIS process, even though it sounds like this is a done deal, there's been a task force and things have been decided, the EIS process is actually the best chance in a generation for the public to get involved in this decision making, which was what was always intended by these environmental laws. It wasn't when you're going to take an action so drastic as to demolish something on the National Register and do so much work out in a very sensitive marine environment. Those decisions are intended to have a very public component. And, you know, we're sort of inviting this debate here. The city is going to open up a process, and I know it seems like it's been a really long time, but I think what we really want to get across, and working very closely, of course, with the local people here, is that the public finally will have that opportunity.
Even though they think they sort of already had that opportunity not that long ago?
Do you mean in the 90s with the last process? Well, they did.
And we see how long it's been as this keeps revolving.
And the conclusion of that process was to restore it. And the money was appropriated to do that. And so, you know, obviously some people want restoration.
But then with the task force that Rick called about and just the reverse of that, and then you heard what Jeff had to say, trying to get to some sort of definitive decision just hasn't been able to happen.
Right. And now, you know, we're strongly supportive of the action the city is taking now in doing an EIS. We think we're going to get at the heart of the issue here. And we want to be a part of it. That's what we're saying with this announcement.
All right. We've got lots of callers. We want to hear what you have to say. We're going to go off now to Elaine calling us from Honolulu.
Hello?
Aloha, Elaine. Welcome to Town Square. Hi there. Thanks for your patience.
I am so happy that the decision has been made to try to preserve this. It was heartbreaking that it wasn't going to be preserved at one point, it seemed. I'm hoping that even though my children did not get to enjoy it, that someday my grandchildren may be able to get to enjoy this. And if in the big picture we can, not even a second, talk to somebody halfway around the world, I'm sure we can somehow restore this very beautiful and very significant memorial to the war veterans of World War I.
But Elaine, you made the point that you're happy that this decision has been made. There really isn't a decision. I mean, that's part of...
Well, there's talk on the table, basically. I thought it was a done deal. They were going to destroy this beautiful thing. And now that somebody wants to, the federal government or somebody wants to make it...
It's not the federal government. It's the National Trust. And they would probably be the first ones to tell you, hey, everybody thinks that we're the federal government, but they're not. They're privately funded. They're a nonprofit. And they've added their voice to it by putting it on the list of national treasures. Thanks so much for your call. Going now to Britta calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Britta.
Aloha. And thank you, National Treasury and NPR, for bringing this subject up. Again, in 1977, I swam in the natatorium. The gentleman's right. There was coral growing in the natatorium, and thank God in 30 years there still is. So I vote for restoration, reduce, and reuse, in that that is a pool where there's a natural ecosystem. The aquarium is right around the corner. I believe that Duke Kahanamoku and the gentlemen that gave their lives for our freedom in World War One would appreciate having that restored and possibly used for monk seals that might need some protection, the sea, green sea turtles.
So you don't necessarily, hang on a second, you don't necessarily see this as being, you know, restored to being a swimming pool. Doesn't that sort of defeat the purpose of restoring it to what it was supposed to be?
Well, I think that given the fact that corals are endangered, and if you looked in it, you would notice, like I said, I haven't seen it since 1977. I'm a bit removed. I'm on the Big Island. If you were to look in there, there is an ecosystem in there. And I think that the just people, like possibly something on the stadium where people could see maybe the original part, but then also see creatures in there. And I think that that would continue with a living memorial and possibly
be a little different.
I mean, I think environmentally not disturbing the water. You know, my son is a diver, and in the last some odd years, I mean, if you go to Waikiki, the ecosystem and the coral doesn't only suffer because of humans being there. Sunscreen in the water is destructive. That's just food for thought.
All right. Well, thanks very much for your call. We appreciate it. But for a lot of people, I mean, the two of you sitting here with me here, David Brown and Brian Turner, I mean, you're hearing people grapple with how do we somehow preserve the meaning of the natatorium and make it useful, make it appropriate to where we are right now. What, you know, Britta was suggesting, I don't know that a lot of people would want to have a pool that would be filled with other creatures. They might as well go out in the ocean for that. But what would make the pool itself trainable and usable and useful in a way that would be different from the ocean and that would maintain its integrity? All of those questions that we all keep swimming around as we keep talking about this. And if you want to talk about it with us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to go off to Mark calling us from Waikiki. Aloha, Mark. Thanks for your patience.
Aloha. This is one for Mr. Brown and Mr. Turner. If that EIS comes back and it says the natatorium can't be rebuilt, that it has to be demolished, then what would you say to that?
Good question. So let's say we get the EIS back and it says, you know what, it's just not feasible to try to restore it. What would you say?
Well, it's a dealing in a hypothetical, and it's always hard for us because we're taking this one step at a time. I think one of the things we really have to keep in mind as this process moves forward is what it would take to actually remove the structure from the shoreline. And one, you know, in addition to being a great resource, a rehabilitated pool would be, I think that preservation has a really practical purpose here. Keeping intact a structure that has stabilized the marine environment, as the other caller suggested, you know, for a generation, there's giant foundational piles, 11 on each side, that go out. And, you know, we have to also think about the consequences of pulling all that stuff out. So, you know, I'd rather not get into the hypothetical of what if the decision doesn't go our way. We'll get to that.
Does the memorial structure defeat public safety?
Not necessarily. If it was designed in a way, you know, we think it could be designed in a way that would actually accommodate handicap accessibility. It really offers an opportunity for a marine experience that other people can't have.
But studies have shown that saltwater pools are unsafe, and that's why they're getting rid of them.
I disagree with that point. There's saltwater pools all over the world. Australia has quite a few. One person very familiar with the rock pools in Australia told us today that there's one in every community. So obviously there is engineering out there that's been done to make them safe for the public.
Mark, thanks so much for your call. Glad to hear from you. Going off to Maui now, and we're going to talk to Buck. Aloha, Buck. Welcome to Town Square.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. You know, I'd like to see, I think it's really a shame if it can't be. I'd like to see it used for what it was originally built for. I remember when we were small kids and we'd get bussed down by the schools or the summer fun, and swimming in the natatorium was just this, it was like an experience. Even though I was too small and they wouldn't let me jump off the tower, I still had the feeling that I was connecting with the Duke and Johnny Weissmuller and Buster Crabbe and all the famous swimmers and that whole tradition, you know, that I felt like I was a part of the community when I went there. And we'd go down to the public bath concession stand and buy shea lace and cuttlefish. And, you know, it was just this, there was this whole stretch of like, magnificent old Waikiki that's all gone now. The duck ponds are gone, and the bridges are gone, and the bandstands replaced.
And well, and you know what? I would ask you, Buck, if you know, if some of those same feelings about what's gone. I mean, we have these very melancholy feelings, many of us, about what has gone away that's never going to be there again because life changes and communities change and development happens and all that kind of thing. Would you be swayed the other way if, you know, to put up the shoe on the other foot, if you found out that this couldn't be done, would you be okay with that?
I'll say two things. One, those that don't learn from history, repeat it. Number two, those that learn from history, go kicking and screaming, saying, don't do that, as those who haven't learned from it, repeat it. We've got to learn from our past. That was, you know, when gracious living and manners and civilization and people were nice to each other. Now, you know, they just go and kick sand in your face. I think that we need to be reminded of our graciousness and what living in Hawaii was all about.
If it can be done safely, if it can be done financially, appropriately, I think all those questions are still out there, and it all hinges on what we're all going to see next year in that EIS. David?
Yes. Beth Ann, I think the conversation we're having today is exactly what preservationists want to see. You have people who are passionate about their community, and they care about the future of the community. And that's really all that we as preservationists can ask for in these kind of conversations. So you asked earlier, what does it mean that we're hearing this? And I think that's a very good thing.
But as people are drawing sides on this, and clearly you're hearing this because
sure,
this is nothing new. It may be
exactly
a newer experience for the two of you, but for folks who are here and have done this now for, you know, 30 years, had these kinds of arguments, it's becoming, you know, we're on this side or you're on that side of it. And you as a preservationist, somewhat removed from all of this, how do you create any sense of, you know, conciliation? Or, I mean, obviously it's going to happen at some point where there is a decision and there is a firm plan.
Sure. And I think having, as Brian suggested earlier, making sure that there's the conversation that takes place where the public is involved, as there was in the 90s, and a decision was made to restore it is important. So that people feel they're part of that conversation, I think is important. But I also think that the last caller was talking about, and you were going back and forth with him about the changes in community. And I think communities that work best are ones where you can see a continuity, and it's sort of a continuous community. And that's what's important, because there's things from the past that inform what we are today, and there are things thinking about the future that can learn from what we've done in the past. And that's what we're trying to see in community.
All right. We've got some more community folks who'd like to get in on this conversation and talk to you. Going to go now to Dee calling us from Manoa. And if you'd like to be next, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Aloha, Dee.
Hi.
Hi there.
I went there in the fifth grade to learn to swim. I swam for Suichi Sakamoto there summers when I was in high school, and heard lots of different suggestions. But one I heard that I did like, and because the pool is really horrible, I mean, it was horrible then, it's horrible now, and was that somebody suggested they just fill it in, leave it like it is more or less, and fill it in and use it for a sand volleyball tournament thing. So that's or reuse it in some way, because it's going to cost money to do anything. Okay, that's it.
All right, Dee. Thanks very much for your patience and for your brevity. We appreciate that. The idea of you know, repurposing this in some other way, not having it be a pool, does that still fulfill the criteria as you see it? Brian?
Well, with preservation, there's always a sliding scale. And perfect preservation here would be completely honoring that original design intent of Lewis Hobart, who was the architect who designed this in the 20s. It may be at the end of the day that that's not completely feasible, or there are certain things that might be altered to make it better. So it might reduce its eligibility a small degree, but not enough to make it ineligible. So this happens all the time with rehabilitation projects on historic buildings. And I would encourage the caller when the city starts the process this summer, they're going to be asking the public, what alternatives do you want us to see developed here? What do you think we should study? What have we missed that we haven't looked at already? And the caller can write and say, I think this should be a volleyball court, and I think this should be an alternative that you should explore. You should look at the costs. You should look at how it would affect the design intent and the integrity. Right now, we want to see the city honor that original design and make again a great aquatic, vibrant aquatic center at the Natatorium, because, of course, this structure was built to honor those indigenous swimming traditions that really made history in the early 20th century. And the Great Duke swam there, and Buster Crabbe, Johnny Weissmuller, as another caller said. So, that would be our preference here.
But part of that means it has to be done safely, and it has to be something that is going to protect the health and well-being of those people who might be using that in a very different way than, certainly we have many more health considerations now than we did in the 20s when that was first built, and certainly a bigger body of knowledge. So if all that were to happen, that would be fine. But if not, clearly from what you've just said, you would be open to perhaps an alternate use to be able to keep it. So part of what I'm getting at here is this is not necessarily an either-or conversation, but it's and, or could we? And that seems to be what the both of you are suggesting as this process goes forward.
Yeah. Fundamentally, what we want to see is public participation here.
All right. We've got more participating right now, going off to Dan calling us from Ala Moana. Aloha, Dan. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, aloha. Yeah, you're right. It's going to be the environmental impact statement. My opinion is that I'm going to hypothesize that it's never going to be a saltwater pool as it once was. It's just a 1910 thing, and before then it was different. And it's a science experiment right now, just growing whatever's in there. It's not pristine anymore. It's a wreck. It would have to be an entirely new structure. It could be a freshwater pool, but that's just kind of a different thing. And then you're talking, I'm thinking lots of public costs. If someone were to say, hey, there's going to be not a cent of public money is going to be spent on this, lifeguards, everything else, that's not realistic. I think, it's like what you keep in your home as a memento, as a family heirloom. There's certain things that you keep, but you can't keep everything, and you got to pick and choose. I say this, I would like to see it turned into a beach. I'll say that right up front, just plain beach. I'm not entirely against the volleyball thing. That seems kind of sensible. I say this as someone, my granduncle, my granddad's brother, was in World War I. He was in a pile of dead bodies. He barely made it. He became an architect. He actually, all he had was the flu. It wasn't from war injuries or anything like that. But World War I, they have the plaque there. I've been down there. I'm a beach user. And they should be, they're memorialized as I see it already. And you can't just have every single president that comes along can't have an eternal flame. And we're just going to be, it gets overwhelming just with the sheer public cost. And so that's my point of view on it. And I thank you for letting me express that.
Thanks very much, Dan. And I'm sure both gentlemen around the table here will say that you should be involved with that process as it moves forward. Thanks very much for the call. Going now to Pat, calling us from Kauai. Aloha, Pat.
Hi.
Hi there.
Aloha.
Before you get going, Pat, I'm going to ask you to please turn down your radio because we're getting feedback and we can't hear you very well.
I was just listening. I wanted to say a couple of things. One, I don't believe in the words can't or never. And two, it's really hard to hear people here in this state say something about we can't get help from the mainland or from people who have different experiences from us. I don't believe that either. I believe that the people who are here suggesting or maybe even saying that they would do an EIS have some answers that we have not had before and that we might be able to learn from.
Well, the EIS is required regardless whether the trust would be involved or not.
And I also feel very strongly that when people on this island, especially those people who are non-natives, say something like, you know, unless you have some experience like we have, but ignore the importance of Native people, then there is not a really good reality in what they're saying. That's not to negate the experience that they have at 50, 70 years here, but the intention in having World War I monument is historic to me because I came from the mainland at one point and really never saw any recognition of the power of what happened in World War I.
So that was the first thing that you saw that actually brought the history of World War I to you?
Not the first thing, but it is...
I mean, the first type of monument, or the first monument of any sort.
Of any real... I guess any real quality.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there for the moment. I'm glad you had that experience. Pat, I'm sorry. We got to say goodbye to you for the moment, but thanks very much for calling us. Going to go off now to Rike, calling us from Neo Valley. Aloha, Rike. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. For once, I don't have an opinion.
Really?
I have a question, though, and that is maintenance. We have the worst record of maintaining anything we have. And will that be figured into the equation?
David would like to answer you on that one. David Brown.
Well, I think that's a great question. And one of the reasons that we're having this conversation today and that the citizens of Honolulu and Hawaii have been having this for 35 years is because the building wasn't maintained after it was built. And that's a real issue in this country. We look at crumbling infrastructure all over the country in every state, and it's a real issue. And so I think there are questions of maintenance, but there's questions of maintenance with the beach as well. And I think you all know much better than I do in terms of what type of maintenance is required of a beach and especially one here at Waikiki. And I think those are all legitimate questions to be put into the public conversation about what's possible, what's not possible, and what's the best for the community with the natatorium.
And where is that income stream going to keep coming from after whatever is done?
That's right.
How do you maintain it so that we don't have another crumbling situation
exactly
in another couple of decades or more? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Is our number. If you'd like to get to us very quickly before we have to say goodbye, we can talk to you if you want to do that. Otherwise, I'm going to ask the two of you some questions about this, because for many of our callers, and you hear the way that this is just living in people's guts, what advice do you have for all of us as we begin to grapple with this and move forward, as you've had other experiences in other places around the country where they are no less passionate about their possible areas of preservation as we are about this one? What do you suggest that people do to be able to have, if not just a civil conversation, but one that looks at many of the different possibilities so that the best solution can come up?
Well, I think you said it, Beth Ann, best. We tend to look at these things as black and white. It's either this or this. And going through a public process, we often do this with historic sites and historic buildings, we actually find a better solution by having the conversation and saying, what are the possibilities here? And Brian was talking about how we often with historic buildings don't get the perfect restoration, and in many instances we don't, But think of all the communities that are now thriving because we have adaptive reuse of historic buildings in new and interesting ways. And so I would say use this public process to think about a myriad of opportunities and be open to the, what those are.
All right, we're going to take one more call from Mandy from Manoa. Aloha, Mandy. We'll ask you to be brief, but good to talk to you, and welcome to Town Square.
I unfortunately could not listen to the first part of the program, and one of my concerns is we're talking history. How about the fact that where the natatorium is where first the warriors of Kahikili and after that Kamehameha landed when they came to conquer Oahu. And so if we're going to go back and talk about history, then let's go all the way back. Let's have a beach the way it was when Kahikili and his forces and Kamehameha and his forces landed.
Manny, thanks very much for the call. She brings up the point, okay, if you're going to talk about preserving history, you got to ask the question, whose history?
Well, and I think that's fair, and I think that's part of the public conversation. I'm not sure the beach that's being proposed to be restored was the beach that would have been seen at the time that she's pointing out. And part of what we see in communities is layered history, and things happen on top of other places. And that's an important part of understanding the story. And you can certainly, as we think about what the future of the natatorium is, we can think about how do we honor the earlier history that took place there as well. And that's certainly something we see at a lot of historic places.
When you do see this and you have these levels and layers of history, how do you accord what weight to which one?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a question we're always grappling with. And I would just note, we're very sensitive to that concern. But like David was saying, you know, at the time the natatorium was built, there was very little beach along Waikiki. We heard an oral history yesterday of somebody who swam there in the 30s, and he said there was about a 10-foot strip of sand at Kaimana Beach. And now that's expanded largely because of the littoral drift has created the sandy beach there. As far as layers of history, that's what is so interesting about preservation to me, is because our intent, you know, in having these dialogues, we always want to honor all, you know, that's our goal. But there's a question of how to get there. And that's why community input is so important. We're not coming here and saying we have the answer. We want to facilitate that dialogue, and I think we can get there. And processes like are happening with our environmental laws, which we, you know, defend, are a good start.
And first opportunity for people to do this?
Well, we're told that there will be a meeting this summer. That's all we know.
But we don't actually have a date yet, so stay tuned. As soon as we have one, we will have one out there for you. I want to thank both of you for taking time. I know you've got to catch a red-eye flight, David Brown, and get back to D.C., and you'll be going there shortly too, Brian Turner. Both of you, thanks very much for being here. Brian Turner is a senior field officer and attorney for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. David Brown is the executive vice president and chief preservation officer. Thanks very much for joining us tonight and spending the hour with us. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning right here at 8 o'clock for The Conversation. We'll see you then. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.